JSA in the 90s. This episode, Justice Society of America number 2, cover dated September 1992. Hello, and welcome to JSA in the 90s, a podcast dedicated to the Justice Society of America and related characters as published in the 1990s. We are a proud member of the Fire & Water Podcast Network. My name is the Irredeemable Shag, and I am your host. But guess what? I have brought along a friend. In fact, each episode, I invite a guest host to help me tackle an issue of the JSA. Now, my co-host today is the newest member to join the Fire & Water Podcast Network. He's got a show focused on an amazing Amazon who also just happens to be a former member of the JSA. Finally, I figured I better have this guest on the show soon before this upcoming election, as he's from Arizona, and I'm not sure his state will survive the experience of counting ballots. Folks, the only state in America that makes Florida look sane. Folks, help me welcome Mr. Sean Ross. How you doing, buddy? Welcome to the JSA Brownstone. Thanks for being here.
Hey, man, I'm good. We don't count ballots in Arizona. We count vibes, man. We just throw them up in the air and shoot them, and whichever ones still fall down, that's who gets our electoral votes.
That's how the hanging chad worked. It's exactly the same.
Yeah. It's exactly how it worked, man. But really, somebody from Florida?
Right, exactly.
Come on, man.
The narrator, he said from inside his glass house.
Exactly.
So, folks, huge apologies for last episode. It was way, way, way too long. But Mike and I had so much to cover. We had to cover the lead up to the series. I apparently had to do a TED talk on a bunch of numbers for some reason. Then we had to talk about the issue. And then on the back end, we had a tremendous amount of amazing feedback. So that one was very long. This episode's going to be shorter. If it's not, it's entirely Sean's fault. So just know that going in. All right, well, to get things rolling, why don't we go ahead and thank our sponsors right out of the gate, folks. This episode of JSA in the 90s is sponsored in part by InStockTrades.com. InStockTrades is your best online source for trades, hardcovers, and other collected editions, all for up to 42% off with free shipping on orders of $50 or more. Now, each episode will select a collected edition to briefly discuss from the InStockTrades library. Usually, it's tied into this month's issue of JSA in some way, shape, or form. I picked an easy one, and I got to pick before Sean, so I left him with the hard task of finding something else. I picked Justice Society of America, The Demise of Justice hardcover. Now, this is the collected edition that collects the miniseries that came out in the 90s, Justice Society of America issues 1 through 8, which was the miniseries that, well, we'll be covering it in a year or so. And then it also includes Adventure Comics 466 and All-Star Comics 57, which was the last Golden Age JSA appearance in All-Star Comics. Published by DC, obviously. Cover art by Tom Lyle. It's full color. It's a hardcover. Again, it collects that great 8-issue series where they're dealing with Solomon Grundy and Vandal Savage. It's well worth your time. And it's a hardcover, so it's a little more pricey. Normally goes for $39.99, but you can get it for 42% off, so it's only $23.19. That's a heck of a steal for 10 great comics. Now, Sean, did you happen to bring a pick by chance?
Yeah, I did. And actually, I have to say, I'm really, really, really happy with this pick because this is probably the best book I read in the last 5 years.
Wow.
I selected Alan Scott, The Green Lantern, trade paperback. It's written by Tim Sheridan. It is art by Sion Torme. I hope I said that okay. But it covers Alan Scott, Earth's first Green Lantern. He's born with the strength of will, a resolute spirit, a selfless service to the world that would dismiss him because he is secretly homosexual. At a time when this is frowned upon and not allowed in society, he's the most powerful member of the Justice Society of America, but man, his personal life can take him down. This book is a beautiful 6-issue miniseries that just concluded a few months ago and tells the story of Alan Scott and his first love and the connection in that relationship to the Red Lantern, who was a newly created Golden Age villain with ties to the JSA book by Geoff Johns that is rumored to be coming out right now.
Actually, I think the last issue came out the day we were recording.
It did. And I love Johns as a creator, and I love Mikkel Yanin, the artist, as a creator. But that book was so delayed that at a certain point, I just kind of forgot what was going on in it. Mm-hmm. But this trade paperback is amazing. Again, it collects Alan Scott, The Green Lantern 1 through 6. It collects a short story from DC Pride Through the Years, number 1, published by DC Comics, originally $16.99, yours for $9.85. Cannot recommend it enough. It is a beautiful story about a man kind of reconciling with his identity at a time when he wasn't allowed to explore it.
Absolutely endorse that pick. It is wonderful. I was completely captivated right from the first issue. Draws you in. As you mentioned, the art is gorgeous. The story is strong. You care for Alan. It's a different version of love Alan to some extent, folks, that some of y'all may not be used to, but it's equally as valid, and it's telling a really interesting story, and it's very emotional. I mean, you really feel it, and I really got sucked into it, and really cannot endorse that pick enough. You're right. Great pick, man.
Thank you. Yeah, and I just, for anybody who's a fan of the HBO Doom Patrol show and the storyline they did with Larry Trainer, the Negative Man, with his background, it's going to remind you a lot of that emotionally. Very powerful, and just definitely an amazing story. In fact, all three of those miniseries, there was a Wesley Dodd Sandman and a Jay Garrick Flash, they were all great.
I was just going to say, you know, we pick on the recent Geoff Johns series, which did have some great moments in it, but they were supplemented with these three great miniseries, right?
Yeah.
So, I mean, we really were kind of living in a golden age for a while there. We had four books on the stands, or three, and then an occasional JSA issue. So it was a great time to have all those out there. So, again, I didn't even realize it was collected already, so I'm glad you picked this one.
Yeah, it's a great one. Between that and Stargirl, The Lost Children, that was carrying the JSA legacy for the last couple of years while the other main, quote-unquote, main book was taking so long to come out.
That Lost Children. And folks, by the way, if you read Stargirl, The Lost Children, and the Spring Break Special, if you want earlier in this feed, I know JSA in the 90s just started, but this feed, Justice Society Presents, has been going for a few years now. I had a, forgive the guest, he wasn't very good, but I had a guest on to help me cover, obviously it was Sean, to help me cover those Stargirl stories, and they're some of our favorites. We just loved those. So definitely, if you want to hear more on that, you can check out those earlier episodes of the show. So for these and all your other trade paperback needs, please visit InStockTrades.com. Now, this episode is also sponsored in part with your Patreon support, because, you know, running the Firewater Podcast Network with so many shows requires a lot of online hosting and other services. And a while back, we realized we needed some help with the expenses. So we launched the Patreon, and you folks really stepped up to help keep the network going. So if you're enjoying the JSA in the 90s podcast, the best way to support the show is by visiting our Patreon, which is patreon.com/FW podcasts. And while you're there, please consider supporting the Fire and Water Podcast Network. And at certain tiers, you get mentioned on the show of your choice, just like these folks who asked to be recognized specifically on the Justice Society Presents podcast. So our thanks go out to Alex Osias, Bill Beer, Bruno Diaz, David A. Gutierrez, DC Dave, Devin Clancy, George Van Note, Gord Tolton, Jason Keane, Jay Campbell, John Coos, Keechee Baker, Kevin Wetter, Mark Baker Wright, Martin Gray, Matt Ev, Maxwell Traver, Michael Bailey, Michael Crouch, Mike Zumkowski, Roger Preeb, Russell Burbage, Superman Radio Revisited Podcast, Symbol Pending, Ted Kilvington, Tim Price, and some weirdo named Sean Ross. Again, please visit our Patreon at patreon.com/FW podcasts. All right, folks, this is the part of the show where you get involved. I need you to go on social media, find us as JSA Presents. We're on most of the platforms out there. Find us out there and share your thoughts on the show. Get involved. You know, please share the show. Tell your friends about it or tell us what you love. Hit on, you know, whether it be Mike Parabek's art or maybe it's an Alan Scott point or maybe it's about the trade we just discussed, whatever. Be part of the discussion. The easiest way, quite frankly, is on our website, which is fireandwaterpodcast.com/JSA. You can leave the comments there. But also, again, out on all the social medias, we're out there. So check that out. Now, Sean, this is the part of the show where I get to talk to you for a moment and you get to tell us your personal origin story with the JSA. How did you find the book? How did you discover them? Why'd you fall in love with them?
So it's one of my earliest comic book memories, actually. I started collecting comic books in January of 1983 with G.I. Joe number 10, a nice little town called Springfield. Mm. And I collected G.I. Joe comics in part because of the commercials, man. Marvel, that was money well spent by Marvel, because I loved those commercials. I started buying G.I. Joe. I didn't understand that issues came out every month. I didn't understand any of it. I just would go and look and see what appeared. Well, eventually, G.I. Joe wasn't coming out quickly enough for me, so I started buying other comics. And by fall of 1983, I had the bug. I was a full-bore just collector. And I would grab anything off the spinner rack that kind of caught my interest, or if I had money, you know, and I could afford it. So in the fall of 1983, I'm at the spinner rack, and there are two comic books out concurrently. There is Justice League of America 220 by Jerry Conway, Roy Thomas, and the great Chuck Patton, and All-Star Squadron 27 by Roy Thomas and Jerry Ordway, the amazing Jerry Ordway. And both of them feature the Justice Society. So the Justice League of America 220 is the annual JLA-JSA team-up, which I knew nothing about at the time. And it is amazing. I got to see all these new characters. I got to question who they were and wonder about their powers and learn, in that little blurb that DC would do about Earth 2 and Earth 1. I found out that Black Canary is her own mother, which is, this was Lifetime television before Lifetime television. And then the two-parter in All-Star Squadron is the one where Dr. Fate battles Kolak, the sorcerer, and then the Spectre has to fight him as well, and they battle it out. And these two issues are especially memorable for me because this is the explanation. Everything in All-Star Squadron is Roy Thomas explaining things from the Golden Age. This is Roy Thomas explaining how Dr. Fate goes from a full to a half helmet. And as a Jewish guy, I know a thing or four about taking a little off the top. So those two issues really stuck with me and made Dr. Fate just one of my favorite characters. So I imprinted early on the JSA, or more accurately, they imprinted on me, and I have loved them ever since.
Sorry, you threw me there, man.
You weren't expecting the half helmet joke?
No, I was not. Man, 1983, what a magical year. I mean, that's sucked me in too, in my time frame. And, you know, there's a lot to be said for tie-in comics, right? Because you came in through G.I. Joe. What got me starting to collect was Star Wars comics, actually. I didn't even consider myself a comic book collector. I was just buying Star Wars because it was Star Wars. You know, Secret Wars is what I still consider my first, you know, foray into real comics, but I was buying Star Wars because it was just there and I needed more of it. So yeah, there's a lot to be said for the tie-in stuff. There really is.
I'm telling you, one good comic book commercial, just, you know, a whole generation of kids, man.
All right. Well, folks, we are going to get into this now. Remember, as we cover this issue, you can see some of the images from this comic over on our website, which again, fireandwaterpodcast.com/JSA. We're not going to post the whole comic. I mean, come on, you can go out there, you can buy the physical comic, you can read it on Infinite, you can buy the digital version, whatever, get your hands on it. So, but we will put a few images out there for you to see. So first up, we're going to talk about this cover for Justice Society number 2, cover dated September 1992, on the shelves August 4th, 1992, cover price $1.25, 5 shiny quarters. And the cover's drawn by Mike Parabek and Mike Macklin. You want to describe the cover for us, Sean?
Yeah, it's an action cover. We've got Alan Scott, Green Lantern, Jake Garrick, we've got Ted Grant, Wildcat, and we've got Al Pratt, the Atom, fighting a bunch of soldiers. I'm not going to call them goose steppers, but there's definitely an air of JSA versus the Nazis again. And there's a big machine gun firing at Alan, and then the word riot across the cover. It's just Parabek goodness, and, you know, the clean line and a wonderful action shot showing that, hey, you know, these guys may be in their 60s, but they will still kick your butt.
I think it's a great one. And if you read in the Z format, which a lot of marketing people will tell you, people read in a Z, you know, Alan is the first figure you see, right, in the top left. And then basically Jay's the next one you see, which is smart because, you know, issue one was all about Jay and Alan anyway. So you're sort of keeping them the main focus. This isn't so much about the cover, just the design. I love Alan's receding hairline. I don't know what it is about it. I guess maybe because I'm old myself, but I just love that that's the touch to show his age. Because otherwise, you're not really seeing the wrinkles and all that on his face. So I love that's how they demonstrate Alan's getting older. And if I had anything negative to say about the cover, is that the JSA are on the ropes, right? You would think they could beat up some goons, that they shouldn't have trouble with it. So that's the only downside, is that you would think they'd be able to beat up the goons. Now, the flip side of that is it makes for a dynamic and exciting cover. I mean, it looks exciting. There's a big battle going on. And they use the colorist, whoever the colorist was on the cover, used colors very effectively. Because all the superhero costumes really pop, with the exception of Wildcat, because he's dark. But, you know, the other colors really, really pop. And the goons are very, very muted earth green colors and stuff like that. So very smart work on the coloring. Really like it.
Yeah, it's great. And then Jay Garrick's delivering a people's elbow, which is awesome. And so it is, yeah, it's a really fun cover. I love it. And it's Parabek, man. Like, it's, you know, there comes a point in art appreciation for a comic collector, I think, when you start understanding that, like, the clean, simple line, like the Alex Toth kind of school, is the really advanced art, right? Like, that's when somebody's really reached their peak, when they need fewer lines to convey story. And Parabek's just a master.
And his figure work, and this applies to the entire issue, you're right, is absolutely astonishing. He takes cartooning, but he takes it seriously, is the best way I can describe it. Minimal amount of lines, like you said, great use of blacks. Now, I'm going to steal a quote from Chris Franklin here. Last episode, he left a comment describing Parabek's art. He says it's deceptively clean, but incredibly dynamic. Ooh. And that's a really smart way to describe it. So well done, Chris. I'm impressed. Cindy probably wrote it for him. But Well, let's get inside this thing, man. So, written by Len Straczewski, penciler is Mike Paraback, inker is Mike Macklin, letter is Robert Panana, colorist is Glenn Whitmore, and editor is Brian Augustine. The issue is called Days of Valor. You want to start us off?
Yeah, so we begin down in the subway where a protester who's unhappy with the Ultragen Corporation, remember that name, is about to get pummeled by two thugs when two unexpected but delightful heroes step in, Ted Grant and Al Pratt, better known as Wildcat and the Atom. Now, despite their age and recent retirement, they spring into action, taking down the attackers with ease. Ted even hands the grateful protester a business card for personal training, which, I mean, it means the kid's going to be a superhero, right? As they stroll past more protesters, they discuss the questionable corporation Ultragen, which is wreaking havoc on the environment. Al dismisses it as politics before they enter the GBC building, both secretly wondering if the other brought their costume, which is delightful. After passing through a secret entrance, they descend to the basement, where they're greeted by a radiant green light from Alan Scott, the original Green Lantern. Alan and Jay Garrick, the original Flash, have transformed the basement into a meeting space, including super awesome Justice Society relics. Ted is especially thrilled to see his old heavyweight championship belt, but Al scoffs, calling it childish and referring to his friends as museum pieces. He even mocks Green Lantern and the Flash for wearing costumes in their 70s. Now, Ted urges Al to listen. Alan is in his Green Lantern costume. He admits they might be old fools, but, you know, they have returned for a reason, and the Justice Society still stands for something, and they need to rediscover what that is. Al questions the whereabouts of the other members, and Green Lantern explains that Johnny Thunder is the only one yet to check in. Wesley Dodds, the Sandman, is recovering from the stroke from issue one. Ted Knight, Starman, sends his support from New Mexico. Rex Tyler, Hourman, is busy supporting his sick son. And Charles McKnighter, Dr. Midnight, is busy opening a clinic. Why don't you take it from here, Shag?
Will do. So then we hear from Carter and Shiera Hall, Hawkman and Hawkgirl. They are in the Middle East on an archaeological dig. They're also mourning the recent death of their son, Hector Hall, the Silver Scarab. Now, during a video call with the JSA, Carter passes the chairmanship of the JSA to the Green Lantern. Carter also suggests the JSA still has a role to play as mentors to the younger heroes, and he reminisces about his time working with the Justice League and hopes his influence made them better. Suddenly, the Halls are called away due to an urgent situation. Meanwhile, Al and Ted reconsider the Justice Society's purpose, thinking it might be to support the next generation of heroes. They're already thinking about opening a training complex as well. Then Green Lantern receives a call from his wife, Molly, about a dangerous situation escalating in the plaza across the street. Protesters are being attacked by overzealous security guards for the Ultragen Corporation. There's that name again. The Justice Society decide to intervene, with Ted and Al donning their costumes as well. They confront the hostile situation, trying to separate the protesters and the Ultragen security guards, but things spin out of control. The Flash is tased by an Ultragen guard. Green Lantern is shot by the riot gun that fires chunks of wood, incapacitating him. Then Wildcat's overcome by Ultragen stormtroopers. But the Atom turns the tide with an astonishing atomic punch, destroying an Ultragen armored tank in one blow. You might even call it one punch.
Nice.
That diffuses the situation, and the Justice Society emerge victorious. From a remote location, a mysterious bandaged figure watches all of this unfold as he coordinates the efforts of the Ultragen troopers, and he is now furious that the JSA have interfered again. The team returns to their new headquarters, only to be shocked by an unexpected visitor, a blonde man in a business suit who says, "Hi guys, remember me? Who could it be? Well, we don't know, and we're going to have to wait till next issue to find out." All right, buddy, so what'd you think?
I love it, man. This is such a delightful series. There's a fun moment in... I'm reading the floppy, okay. And there's a fun moment in the floppy where EMS, which is like one of the comic... mail-order comic book companies at the time, they always had the white background, and they had all the images of, you know, Wolverine and all these things. They've got an ad in here, and it's like everything, all image. It's all image, Wolverine, Ghost Rider, Punisher, Lobo. And this comic book, like, just stands in the face of that as this delightful, classic, sort of a relic of, I don't know, another time. But here we are all these years later, and this is the only one I want to reread. So, I don't know. It's just a fun moment that stands out, that this is such a delightful book, and it really has stood the test of time. So, I love it. I think it's a lot of fun.
I'm looking at the same ad you're talking about, right? You know, Cable, Ghost Rider, Cyber Force, Shadowhawk. Yeah. Out of all of these things, this JSA book, while it may not be high profile, it has aged so much better than the rest. You can read this today, and it's an enjoyable comic. You go back and read some of those other ones, and it's like, oh, you're suffering through some 90s. I mean, I love me some 90s stuff, but, you know, it's still 90s. This aged so much better.
Well, and what's wonderful, and I'm not, I love 90s comics too, man. I'm not disparaging them, but there is more characterization in this issue than in probably 12 issues from that, you know, their list combined. And I especially love that this book, they're doing a really smart thing. Straczynski's such a good writer. He's doing such a really smart thing where, you know, the pattern of the JSA, which is echoed in the JLA, is to have these pairing offs. You know, if you mm-hmm. have a large team and you want to convey action and you want to convey characterization, you shrink it down. You pair people off. And so this comic book is doing that, where issue one really focused on Jay and Alan. Issue two really opens with the patter between Ted and Al, which is, you know, they're Felix and Oscar, man. They're the odd couple. It's delightful. Al is this tiny curmudgeon, you know, atomic-powered curmudgeon with a just amazing mustache. And Ted is this goofy, you know, punch-drunk ex-boxer who's just really happy to be here and be walking around. And so it's really fun that they're kind of building pairs as they go. And they even do it with the Hawks a little bit. They kind of show that this is going to be coming later in the series. And I think it's such a fun use of the pattern in these books, but kind of subverts it a little bit because it makes it more subtle.
I love that you brought up the Odd Couple, because to me, I actually put down grumpier old men in in my thing. I mean, same actors, but it's their bickering is adorable. And I'm also glad you mentioned Al's mustache, because yes, I mean, like, I love Al's entire look. Like, he looks fantastic. He's got, you know, the male pattern baldness. He's got the white hair around his ears and the back of the head. But yeah, that big bushy mustache is beautiful. I want Al Pratt and Puck from Alpha Flight. I want them to hang out. I mean, like, that it would have been perfect in this era. Now, I want to bring up something that Brian Schufo mentioned in the comments last issue. He says, and I'm going to quote him, "I remember thinking at the time that there might have been something going on between the panels with Wildcat and Adam, which was never followed up in later in the series. It'd be interesting to see after reading every issue if I still feel that same way 30 years later. So I started thinking about it from that perspective. You know, could there be some coding going on here about Wildcat and Adam being in some kind of relationship? And I'm not seeing it necessarily, but Adam is super protective of Wildcat. I mean, extremely protective. Like, he loses his mind about the fact that Wildcat, at any moment, his legs might just give out. You know, the post-crisis disablement that happened to Wildcat might just come back. And it's sort of interesting. So whether you look at them as you know, potentially something more, or just really best friends, it's a beautiful friendship between two adult men that I just adore.
Look, you're talking to a guy who believes that in order to be an X-Men, you have to be at least a little gay. So I am not one to bury homoerotic subtext. I don't see it with these two. They strike me more as Booster and Beetle. You know, it's just a fun kind of two guys who've been friends literally their entire lives and are, you know, they have a patter, right? They have a banter, mm-hmm. but deep down it's, you know, you better not mess with the other one because they'll, you know, the other one will come for you. And it's awesome. I mean, Al Pratt, the way Perovic draws him, he looks like a guy who will yell at you for taking too long to order at a deli. Like, he's just, it's such a great visual. It's so wonderful to see superheroes actually age.
Yeah.
But then also see them in action. And there are like a million nods to continuity in this book, yet they're not in any way impediments if you don't know they're there, right? So like when Al Pratt goes and threatens to punch one of the Ultra Gen guys and he has this like atomic, you know, action around his hand and Ted Grant's like, whoa, wait a minute. I thought you didn't have your superpowers anymore. He's like, oh, I lied. I still have it. But that ties directly back. It's All-Star Squadron 21. They fight Cyclotron. Adam, Cyclotron's a radioactive villain. Adam fights him. He gets irradiated. He gets powers from it. It's also the tie to Nuklon because Nuklon is Cyclotron's grandson in Infinity Inc. I mean, there are all of these delightful little continuity drops through this book, but they're not lampshaded and you don't need to know them to enjoy it. But if you do know them, it makes it even more fun.
No, that's great. That's absolutely correct. And by the way, I just want to mention that one panel where Al does threaten the guy with the glowing fist, the coloring on that done really, everything's in oranges and everything's being lit by his radioactive fist. And Al, and the perspective is fun too, because, you know, Al's the short guy and the punk's taller. And so, but you're looking down from behind him. It's just really, again, it's a tribute to Perovic's amazing take on this book.
Big shout out to the colorist Glenn Whitmore on this book, who, I mean, he's the unsung hero of this book because it is, It is as bright and shiny as Parabex art. It's really wonderful.
Yeah. I do want to do one more call out thing too, or call back thing. So these Ultra Gen punks, right? I mean, they're very, especially in the beginning, they're very purposely designed to look like skinheads, right?
Yeah.
One of them's even got an SS belt buckle. You know, they're carrying a gun, which is reminiscent of the German Luger. I mean, they're not being subtle here. They're trying to throw hints and shade to say, look, you know, they fought the Nazis. These guys are sort of, you know, your modern day descendants of the Nazis. So they're trying to draw that connection. And I guess I'm not going to say it for those of you who may be reading along, but come on, Ultra Gen?
Yeah.
You've all figured this out by now, I hope, right?
Well, there's a moment when they reveal their, you know, new secret base in the basement, and they have this wall of villains, mm-hmm. and they're like, look at our villains, Vandal Savage, Perdegaton, Ultra Humanite, and you're like, just in case you hadn't gotten there.
Right.
You know, we're going to remind you, but it's really wonderful, and even the thing I really love about this issue and this or the early issues of this comic is they're having the conversation in the comic that you are having as a reader, as a comic collector, which is, where do these guys fit in now?
Mm-hmm.
Like, where does the JSA fit? What niche do they fill? Why do we need them when we have, you know, all of these super cool, extreme 90s heroes? And, you know, these guys are balding. They can't grow mullets. Like, you know, how can they save the day? And I love that they're having that same conversation and they're finding the answer in the book. So you feel like you're also okay with the answer. It's just, I mean, it's really, really well written.
Yeah, no, and Adam is sort of the voice of reason to this one. He, like everyone else, is still trying to, or at least acting like they want to play hero. And he's like, guys, you know, we're 70, 60 years old, depending on how you feel. He seems to be the only one willing to accept their age. And I like that he specifically says, if we're going to do something, I want it to be dignified. And I like that aspect of it. And there is a whole reoccurring theme here, the reoccurring theme of age, feeling left behind in your senior years, the value of senior citizens and the experience they can bring in mentoring the next generation. I'm glad that they address this, especially in that era of extreme. You know, this is something that needed to be talked about. And I read this comic as a 20-year-old, and now I'm reading it as a 52-year-old. And let me tell you, I have a very different perspective on it now than I had back then.
Yeah, I really do wish I could kind of go back in time. And because this issue came out right as I was graduating high school, or this series came out. And I wish I could go back in time and kind of ask my younger self, like, what do you think about this conversation that's happening? Like, what are your thoughts? I think I just really liked the art and I thought I liked these characters. So I was in all the way. But I do wonder about it because, reading it now, I read it very differently. I'm like, I feel you, man. Totally get it. I'm like, where do we fit in, man? You know, like, I just keep waiting for one of them to, you know, buy a convertible and sleep with their secretary or something.
Oh my gosh.
I mean, it's such good characterization. It's really smart to say, hey, anybody picking up this book is going to have this question. And as May, the editors at DC, let's go ahead and just take it head on and let's address it and let's make it part of the story. And I love that, man. That's a really clever bit of creation there.
And I like, too, that you're getting in the characters' heads. There's a lot of thought balloons. Well, not a lot, but there are thought balloons in here. Like, there's scenes where, like, the Flash is like, oh, hey, I'm still fat. You know, like, he's faster than a light switch. He's like, he wasn't sure he was going to be. You know, Wildcat's thinking about losing his legs again, things like that. So you get into the private, doubtful thoughts that these senior citizens are having. And, you know, and one thing that occurred to me, by the way, since the last time I recorded it on the first episode is, this was the era where Golden Girls was on TV for, like, I don't know, 87 seasons or whatever it was, right? So if the Golden Girls can be successful, why couldn't this? That's not fair.
Yeah, I mean, I know you know this already because you've been online and this is all over. I mean, you know, Blanche, the woman that played Blanche was 50 when that show was on. She was our age. Like, I can't even.
I know. Sophia, the oldest character on the show, was actually the youngest actress and all this stuff. Yeah,
it's crazy. Just crazy. But I, you know, I agree with it, too. Like, I'm not. This is a weird comparison. I'm not endorsing this person as a politician or a human. But, you know, politician RFK Jr., if you've seen him without a shirt, like, the guy is super buff. I mean, he's clearly on every steroid known to man, allegedly. But, I look at him and I look at these guys and I go, yeah, well, I mean, you know, physically a guy at that age can be in great shape. You know, I mean, again, not mentally or in decision making, but physically, you know, you can see that there are men of that age group that are in great shape. And so I love it. I think it's great. I agree with you. The receding hairlines or the balding is just this nice touch of, like, – hey, they are aging and they are, you know, but there's still a role for them. And it's just, it's literally mapping out legacy in the DC universe, which is going to be the defining quality of this team for the next 20, you know, 35 years, basically.
Yeah. And by the way, you, going back to the physique thing, Hawkman even addresses that. He says, like, nobody is seeing me with my shirt off anymore, right, except for Shiera. they are the Jack LaLanne of the DC universe at this point.
Yeah. And it's nice to check in with them. I mean, apparently the JSA invented Zoom because they do a video call with with the halls in Egypt. And I love this moment where Shiera says, well, you know, things have really gone to pot in the Middle East since we've been gone. And it's like, oh, Shiera, have you never read a history book? Like, when were they not? Like, oh, come on, lady. But it is cool because it's setting up, you know, something happens that captures their attention and that's setting up a future issue. And just a nice little bit of foreshadowing, but character development. And then I really love that Al is a super curmudgeon until Carter says to him, hey, this is a great idea for us to find our way and figure out who we're going to be. And Ted even says to him, hey, you came around quick. And Al's like, well, you know, I always listened to Carter. Carter always got through to me. And that really does echo from All-Star Squadron, where Hawkman was the leader of the JSA and his word carried a lot of weight, especially for a very young Al Pratt. Al Pratt's like 17 when he joins the JSA. So it makes a lot of sense.
I love that connective thread. I hadn't thought about that, how young Al was at that time and that, but just, I love that. You're right. Hawkman makes sense to him. Everything he says about that is great. And I love that, you know, Hawkman takes the moment to pass the chairmanship to Green Lantern because, you know, Hawkman's always been, well, not always, but Hawkman is, you know, most famously the JSA chairman that we all remember, right? You know, Roy Thomas put Hawkman in every issue of All-Star Squadron for that reason. And I love that he carries that weight when he says these things. And there's another thing in here too. You talked about, you know, story nods to continuity nods that you may or may not notice. There's one in here that they don't hang a lantern on, but if you know it, you know it, which is where Hawkman talks about his time as a member of the JLA and how he hopes, you know, some of his talents rubbed off on them. And at this point, that's a post-crisis continuity change. Because, you know, obviously in pre-crisis, there was, you know, the Golden Age Hawkman and there was the Silver Age Hawkman. Well, now the Silver Age Hawkman has been wiped away because now you've got the Hawk World version of Hawkman. So with the continuity fix, which is only a year or two old at this point in 1992, was that Carter Hall was a member of the JSA and eventually went on to be a member of the JLA.
Yeah.
So that's in here, but you don't have to know that. You just read that, oh, he was in the JLA for a while. You know, he hung out with them. They don't even talk too deep about it. They point, there's a couple of panels of him with them, and he's saying he hopes that he had some positive impact on them. So for me, as a Hawkman post-crisis guy, I love seeing that in there. That got me super excited.
Well, and you know, they go even further because they refer to their son, Hector Hall, who's died. He was the Silver Scarab in Infinity Inc. He's killed by Hoth Set, who's the Hawk's enemy from day one and reincarnates with them. He is then reincarnated as the new version of the Jack Kirby Sandman. He dies again. He will later be reincarnated in Dr. Fate. And I think this has got to be a record because that's three reincarnations and no personalities. Like he is a Hector Hall sucks. I liked him as Dr. Fate. I was okay with it. But man, he's a crappy character. And I actively rooted for his death in Infinity 8 because I could not stand him. But it is, again, I mean, this, they're now branching out to Infinity Inc. and Neil Gaiman Sandman. So here's a book that connects to everything.
Please send your hate mail to Peacebound and Down, Wonder Woman podcast.
I will be shocked if there's even one. Well, I'll be shocked if there's even one Hector Hall fan. And again, pre-Dr. Fate.
So I was going to say, yeah, Dr. Fate, I was a big fan of him as Dr. Fate. But yeah, okay, fair. Once you put that caveat in, you're okay. But yeah, who had on their bingo card that they were going to see a footnote referencing an issue of Sandman?
I know.
today? That was not on my bingo card, folks. So,
though I would have killed for a Mike Parabek drawn issue of Sandman. I mean, come on.
My brain is literally exploding with the possibilities of Neil Gaiman purposely having like a dream of a cartoon character and it's drawn by Parabek or something like that. Like Popeye has a dream or something. The Atom. So here's something too. They don't even mention it, but it's right there. Is Adam's wearing a new costume? This is a complete I shouldn't say complete, but it's a modernization of his costume with a lot of different tweaks and things like that. No big announcement about it. He's just wearing it. And I love his new costume. It just looks right. And you're probably flipping right now going, that's a new costume? But yes, it is.
I'm glad they gave him a new costume because the old one showed a lot of flesh. And, you know, for a guy who was just complaining about being in his 70s, more coverage is better. But as a fellow hair suit man, I appreciate any time the penciler takes the time to draw all the arm and, you know, leg and chest and back and, you know, all the hair in. And, you know, and I think that's great. I love it. I love Al as this, you know, hairy little man. And I would love, you know, I think you said it earlier, I'd love to see a team up with him and Puck from Alpha Flight.
Right, right. Well, I just think it's sort of unfair that Starman, you know, took a beating for, you know, in issue one for having a green cowl from a lot of folks. And, you know, and Al gets a whole new costume, and I've never heard anyone even mention it. And yeah. So, yeah. Now, it looks great, though. It looks fantastic. And that full-page splash of Adam punching the tank, oh, my gosh. I mean, that's – in the era of Extreme, you know, Parabek knew when to use the splash page, and it looks great.
Yeah, and it's such a nice moment for him because he's been the most reluctant of them in this whole issue. And then he just stands in front of this tank and, you know, his buddy's like, whoa, are you okay? And then just hammers it out. I mean, and it's awesome. I always liked him. I can't say I love always when a character who doesn't have powers suddenly gets them.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's not always my favorite thing, but I've always liked Adam with kind of atomic powers. I've always thought it helped that character. So I'm glad they let him keep, you know, his atomic punch. I think it's awesome.
Oh, yeah, because otherwise he's just, you know, a guy. He's a pugilist. That's it, you know?
Yeah.
So it's great. And it's not overpowered. I mean, he's not, like, you know, lifting skyscrapers. He's not, you know, I don't even know if strength comes with it or if it's just an energy punch. I'm not, and now I think about it, I can't even remember. But it's a great minimalist power, but enough to make you a superhero. So it makes perfect sense.
And it's a nice touch that using it exhausts him. That's a nice little limitation. Yeah.
All right, so I did say in the initial episode that when I see something I don't like, I'm going to call it out and not dwell on it. So I'm going to call something out here, which is that in this store issue, which is a lot of fun to read and exciting, when you really step back from it, though, and think about it, you know, these goons, which are just basically troopers with some devices, you know, with some, like, you know, riot gear, they got the upper hand of the Justice Society. You know, they took out Green Lantern, The Flash, Wildcat. You know, from a writing perspective, it does make for an exciting story and gives Adam the great, you know, ending there. But it's not necessarily the best look for the team in issue number two when you're trying to grab new readers, you know, in the age of Extreme and your team gets beat up by some mall cops, you know. So I'm not happy with that. But it still created an exciting adventure scene. And again, I liked Al getting the big hero moment.
Yeah, no, and I agree with you. It feels a little like season one of Justice League Unlimited, or, you know, Justice League, where they fire a ray that knocked Batman and Superman out. And you're like, wait, what? You're like, the thing that knocked Superman out should have killed Batman. But
right.
Yeah, and they definitely don't look great at first. And I mean, even, and some of it's a little silly, like the riot gun that fires chunks of wood.
Right.
that's pretty silly. And
it looks like it hits Alan with a cork.
I mean, that is exactly, like, it looks like he stood too close to a champagne bottle being opened. And so you're right, they don't come off super great, but I think that's even part of it is, you know, them sort of getting back in the habit. I mean, they've been fighting Ragnarok, you know, for potentially 1,000 years off panel. And so it's, you know, them kind of catching their second wind and getting their groove back. But it does paint a little bit of an uphill battle if the majority of your readers are looking for cool image badassery. And so I can see why I loved this series and I loved it back then. I can see why maybe it didn't click with the zeitgeist at the moment, but it's one of those things that in retrospect stands far above its peers.
Yeah, and that one story point I pointed out that's not my favorite, so much characterization, so much incredible artistry in the book. Just forget my concern. Honestly, just wave it away because the rest of the book, the whole package is so entertaining. So yeah, the calculus at the end is this is still a great issue. Absolutely. Yeah.
Well, and I do have to ask you about that last page, that splash page where they walk in and there's a guy sitting in the chair and he's been commenting on how, you know, that even their secret headquarters looks old. I know it's not him, but this is a full Maxwell Lord moment, right? Like,
oh my gosh,
so much like Maxwell Lord in JLA or in Justice League 1 and then 4, you know, barging in.
in and sort of taking over.
Okay, so first off, yes, it totally is. Second off, you've got my brain exploding now with ideas. Like, I know who this character is, and I know what's going on in their lives. I'm not going to say, folks, because we'll reveal it next issue. But could you imagine if this character had operated in a Maxwell Lord sort of role with the JSA? How amazing that would have been!
That would have been really cool. Yeah, I do think they're kind of going for that moment, because this felt so much like a Maxwell. I literally did a double take when I got to the end of this and went, is that Maxwell Lord? I was like, no, that hair's blonde, but it feels like Maxwell Lord.
Yes. So yeah, they purposely, we don't see the guy's face, just so you folks know. They're all looking at him and they're like, I don't believe it. You know, holy smoke, you. So clearly they know this person, but we don't. But yeah, it does feel very much like when Maxwell Lord just barged in on the Justice League and took over. So yeah. Oh, wow. So it is, it's a fun cliffhanger, but you guys can decide next issue whether it was worth it or not.
Right. Yeah. I don't know that the payoff is, but I'm secretly glad it's not Maxwell Lord, because I wouldn't want him to shoot Adam in the back of the head in 20 years.
Oh, too soon.
Too soon.
Yeah. Now, I will say, when you're looking at the physical copy, there is no letters page this time. Last time we got like a write-up on the JSA. This time they just gave us a big image of issue number 3's cover, which is, you know, okay, that's fine. I would have preferred a write-up from Mark Waid or something, but okay.
It is. It's nice to see the cover. For a minute, I was like, is Dr. Midnight asleep? And then I was like, oh, wait, he's blind. I did do a double take, but it's a nice little bit of promotion for the next issue.
Yeah. So house ads, I won't mention these all the time, but there's some fun ones in there. Heckler, Martian Manhunter, American Secrets. There's a subscription ad featuring Batman. And then there's an ad for Hammerlock, which actually, reading this, drove me to go out and read the first like 4 or 5 issues of Hammerlock just in the past week or two. And it was just kind of fun to, you know, a comic I'd never read before. So, you know, what is it? If it's new to me. So that was kind of a fun little detour that I took thanks to reading this.
Well, and Chris Sprouse is such a great artist. I mean, I can't see his work without thinking of Tom Strong, and you know, I mean, the guy's amazing. And
yeah,
and so I know we've come to the end of the issue, but before we really wrap up the issue, I do have a secret question for you.
Oh noes. Okay.
Yes. Yeah. And this is a deceptively easy question, but the choice is going to overwhelm, I think. So this is JSA in the 90s. This is all about, you know, the world's first super team during the 1990s. And this team is all about legacy. So Shag, who is your favorite legacy character from the 90s?
Do I have to be specific to the JSA?
No, not at all.
Okay. So I actually have a long list. I keep in my head a running list of my favorite superhero characters of all time. And it's a list of 8, and it's always there. So I have to take off a couple that are not legacy. Firestorm comes off, Blue Devil comes off, Daredevil comes off. Okay. But that leaves me with Wally West, which is a legacy character. It leaves me with Tim Drake, legacy character. Kyle Rayner, legacy character. I can take Aquaman off the list. I've actually lost count of my numbers there. I don't know how many I just named. Anyway, so those are my favorite legacy characters. But if I want to veer specifically into the JSA/Golden Age group, my favorite legacy character then would be the Ray from the 90s. I absolutely love Ray Terrell. Yeah, so really, really like. What about you, man?
No, those are all great choices. I mean, thinking of the 90s, Kyle Rayner jumps. I mean, he's my favorite Green Lantern, and, you know, created in the 90s. I love Ray Terrell as well. I'm going to cheat, and you gave more creative answers, but the best series of the 90s in my mind is Starman by James Robinson.
Oh my gosh, yeah, absolutely.
Cody Harris. So I'm going to go, I mean, Jack Knight's a slam dunk for me as the best legacy character created in the 90s.
Oh, yeah, I mean, there's no denying that whatsoever, and I can't believe I didn't mention that. Sometimes I feel like I don't deserve to like Starman, because when I read it, I'm like, there's so much going on here I don't get. There's so many references, like pop culture references. I have no idea what James Robinson is talking about or whatever. I don't feel smart enough to read it. But I do want to tell you folks at home, you know, I've told you we're going to be doing spotlight episodes throughout the run of JSA in the 90s. There is so much Starman content, and it's so critical to the JSA through the 90s. I'm not just going to do one episode on Jack Knight. I'm going to sort of sprinkle it in different ways through a few different episodes. So we're going to get a lot of Jack Knight discussion over the course of the JSA in the 90s for sure. Yeah. Glad you mentioned him.
That makes me so happy.
Yeah.
That series, it's funny because when I catch myself, you know, falling into the easy trap of disparaging the 90s, I have to stop and remind myself about like, oh, wait, no, Starman's from the 90s. The, you know, Tom Payer, Rags Morales, Our Man series is from the 90s. Like, there was great stuff in the 90s.
Oh, absolutely. Now, I'm going to throw a caveat at you. The Our Man series started in the 90s, finished in the 2000s, and more issues were published in the 2000s. So I'm going to hold my Our Man coverage, because I love that series too, until JSA in the 2000s. But that is another fantastic one. Absolutely. And yeah,
you are such an incredible nerd for knowing that.
You think I didn't have to do – believe me, I've been doing research for months on how I'm going to structure this series. So there's a lot of it. Stars and Stripes is the same thing. Starts in the 90s, finishes in the 2000s. I'm covering in the 2000s. Anyway, it's a whole complicated mess. But Jack Knight is – you know, he's kind of the foundation for why we got the JSA book in 99. Without Jack Knight, we don't get that JSA book, I don't think.
No, I agree with you. I mean, he's, you know, right on the cover. And even though he's not a member for very long, and I mean, you almost can barely count him as one, he definitely is the selling point of that book early on.
Yeah. And James Robinson proving that you can tell an interesting JSA story, you know, in the 90s, which is what he would tell in those times past or whatever, which is what made them go, okay, yeah, we can make this work. So, all right. Yes, we are at the end of the issue. So this is the point where we're going to nominate the All-Star Award. This is where we're going to nominate our favorite moment from this issue, whether it's a story beat, something in the art, something that made us laugh, you know, whatever. Both myself and Sean are going to pick one moment to spotlight, and those moments will earn an All-Star Award. So, what you got, Sean?
So the heart of this issue for me is the friendship between Al and Ted. It reminds me of my relationship with my best friend. We've been friends since we were 14. And, you know, we will say things to each other that are just mean and would shock anybody around us. But we both laugh and we know the origin of it. And we're also the first ones to, you know, step in if somebody says anything or, you know, look sideways at the other person. So I love the moment. It's a quiet moment, but I love the moment after Ted has jumped in to save the protester and Al's yelling at him. And Al says, you know, Ted says, I thought you lost your superpower. And Al says, I lied. Sue me. I stole the superpower. And Ted has this great look on his face. And he goes, there goes my best friend.
Aww.
Yeah, it's a sweet moment of just, you know, loving your friend, you know, at his most curmudgeonly. So not the shiniest moment, not the brightest moment, but a moment of real heart.
Well, I think it does sort of encapsulate the whole heart of the issue is that friendship. So no, that's a beautiful moment. I, on the other hand, went for some sparkly pedazzle 90s extremist, which is that full page splash of Al just totally smashing that tank to pieces. It's such an exciting moment. The lead up to it too, where you get like three panels of the tank getting closer and coming towards Al, and Al is just standing there. He's like, you know, you think he's just there to take it, you know, and Wildcat, that friendship again, he's scared. He's like, Al, you know, he even yells the real name when they're in costume and then Al just plows into it. So that's my moment. So both are absolutely fantastic moments. Congratulations. Those moments have won the All-Star Award. Please wear it with pride. The award is as tangible as our love for those moments. Now, Sean, I need to ask a favor. Would you mind hanging out here for a bit? Because I need to go do listener feedback, and I need to make sure that no one else is just going to randomly walk into this brand new JSA headquarters, you know, like into the top secret HQ of a premier superhero team. I'm thinking maybe you could, I don't know, lock the door or something. I don't know. Could you help out?
I can help out. I want to hang out because Ma Hunkle has the best stories of all time. So, you know, I'm going to go listen to some Ma Hunkle stories.
I envy you. That sounds like a lot of fun. So, folks, don't worry. Sean will be back at the end of the show. But after this podcast promo break, I am going to read your listener feedback in our Society Pages section of the show.
To confront the ultimate killers, I must construct the ultimate alias.
Hey, who is that lady? I think she could fly.
To combat the murderers who destroy my family, crush my own life on their way to consuming everything, I must become a greater, more fearsome destroyer.
Hey man, somebody killed this lady.
To track down the animals who prey on the innocent, I must stalk them first. I am no longer their quarry. I am the Huntress.
You can listen to The Huntress Podcast online at thehuntresspodcast.com, at Apple Podcasts. Go to Twitter at Huntress Podcast. And again, this shares a feed with the Batgirl Cassandra Cain Podcast. Cheers.
The Society Pages. All right, folks, in Society Pages is the segment of the show where we cover your feedback from the previous episode. And the title Society Pages, of course, is taken from the letter column title from this JSA series. So before we get into your feedback, just a little bit of news. Folks, this is literally breaking news at the time I record this. I have only found out about this in the last hour. And special thank you to Michael Bailey, Chris Franklin, and Kevin Wetter, and probably 70 other people who have sent this to me since then. And I don't mean that in a sarcastic way. I mean, sincerely, thank you so much for you folks for sending stuff my way, information. So there has just been announced a Superpowers action figure 3-pack. Yeah, 3 figures in 1 pack featuring Ted Knight Starman, Alan Scott Green Lantern, and Rex Tyler Hourman. I'm not kidding you. They're in the Superpowers scale from McFarlane Toys. It is the classic Golden Age versions of, again, Starman, Green Lantern, and Hourman. There's a link up on Amazon at the time of this recording, which is Tuesday, for a Sunday episode. It says currently unavailable, so I have no idea when pre-orders are going to happen for this thing, but I imagine they're going to go like hotcakes. So holy moly, it looks amazing. So thank you again to probably everyone I've ever met that sent me that link. So thank you. I genuinely appreciate you guys watching out for me. All right, some other news. It is JSA-tober. So that's hashtag JSA-T-O-B-E-R. You can go to the social medias. You can see where people are drawing a different character from the JSA every single day. There's like a specific list of characters you're supposed to draw on certain days. If you use that hashtag, you can find online all the different characters. And it's really been a lot of fun to watch. A lot of the fans contribute drawings. A lot of people listening to the show have contributed drawings. So it's been really cool to watch. You can see a lot of those on Twitter and other places like that. Now, I just want to clarify one thing in the episode, and this is just me being completely self-indulgent, but Sean and I were talking about favorite legacy 90s characters, and I rattled off some of my favorite superheroes, and I totally froze on some names. So I just want to clarify, again, this is just because it's my show and I feel like doing it. I want to clarify who my 8 favorite superheroes are. The first 5 are always there. It's Firestorm, Aquaman, Blue Devil, Dr. Fate, and Daredevil. Those are my all-time favorite 5. Then there are 3 others that squeeze in, which makes it a top 8 to me. And all 3 of those I mentioned on the show are legacy 90s characters. So Wally West, Kyle Rayner, and Tim Drake. Now, obviously, some of those were created in the 80s, but they really got to shine in the 90s. So those are my other ones. Now, all of those action figures, or all those characters I just mentioned, I have them together as action figures in a display next to my desk. And the funny part is Jack Knight is right in there with them in that display. And I can't believe I didn't think to suggest him when Sean asked. He's a fantastic character from the 90s, obviously. So for you at home, that's a great question. When he shout out in the comments, who is the greatest 90s legacy hero in your opinion? So we want to hear. So put that in the comments, folks. So also in the last couple episodes, I have been giving shout outs to some other fantastic podcasters and websites dedicated to JSA content. Specifically, those are friends of mine. So here's a few more. So in addition to the ones I've mentioned on previous episodes, please consider checking out Barry Reese. He's a buddy of ours. Barry Reese has a blog over on Tumblr called Infinity Inc. Forever. So you can find that at tumblr.com/InfinityInc4ever. So be sure to check that out. Then over on Facebook, there are 4 groups. It's a group on Facebook that I frequent that are all JSA related. So I'm just going to rattle off their names. You can go ahead and Google them in Facebook. They're all worth joining. There's Justice Society of America. Then there's JSA All-Stars and Earth 2, DC's Golden Age Giants. Then the World of the Justice Society of America and Justice Society of America's Comic Book Club. All are fantastic groups, all worth joining. So check that out. Now, again, if I've forgotten any more of my friends that are sharing JSA content on the web, I sincerely apologize. Just drop me a note and I'll be sure to mention you on the next episode. And remember, you can find us on social media, out on Twitter and Threads and Facebook and Instagram and Blue Sky as JSA Presents. But if you want your comments read on the show, to be absolutely sure, the best place is on our website, which is firewaterpodcast.com/JSA. Now, I do have one more request. If you haven't left a review for us on iTunes yet, please consider it. It really helps to raise the profile of the show and attract new listeners. And as a thank you, we will read your entire iTunes review on the air. So all you got to do is go out to iTunes and look for Justice Society Presents and leave your review there. So, all right, now we're going to get into your comments here. I have been pulling these from our website, again, firewaterpodcast.com/JSA, from email, social media, and there is so much. I put this all together in a Google document, all your feedback, and it added up to over 17 16 pages of feedback. You guys are amazing. Clearly, I can't read every word of that. We'll be here the rest of the day. And last episode was so long, I'm still living that down. So I am going to read, just cherry pick bits and pieces to pick out what I feel like some salient points. And I want to make sure I recognize everyone. So I'm going to acknowledge everyone that left a comment on the website and try and read a portion of their comments. And we are going to be covering Justice Society of America number 1 from 1992 with my guest, Michael Bailey. So first up is Sean Ross. I have never heard of this guy. I have no idea who this nerd is. But he says, Shag, great episode. You and Michael had such fun. Easy chemistry, which made the episode extra fun. Well, thank you, Sean, for saying that. I did really have great chemistry with Michael Bailey. I apologize. I didn't have quite as good a chemistry with the guest on the second episode. Can't win them all. So anyway, Sean Ross continues, I haven't forgotten or purposely removed from my memory that the JSA returned in Armageddon Inferno. I'm glad you provided the timeline because I don't ever plan on rereading that miniseries. And then he says, who am I kidding? I'm rereading it right now. And he says, Paperback is an unsung legend of comic artists and deserves a proper spotlight. Yeah, well, as Sean shared with us just a little bit ago. Then we heard from Rockford J. Rockford shared a picture of his wall. He's got a ton of framed art, which is gorgeous, and he happens to have framed the Justice Society of America promotional poster, which was drawn by Mike Paperback. He's got that framed on his wall, and it's the full-size poster. It's absolutely stunning. Then we heard from Andrew R., who says, oh, I have been slowly listening to the backlog, and when I have time, and I have found my people for sure. Now, Andrew also shared his wall, and he also has framed posters of the JSA 1992 series, that same poster that Rockford J shared. In addition, Andrew's got up his Sandman Mystery Theater poster and the 1999 JSA series promotional poster. So I got to say, you guys, I am totally jealous of you folks at home who have that full-size 1992 JSA promotional poster by Paperback. I don't actually have one. I have the smaller version, which was like this flyer, like a free giveaway they gave out in comic shops that you would fold out into a smaller version of that poster. I've got that framed on my wall, but I don't have the big one, so I'm terribly jealous of you folks at home. So then we heard from Hal, who says, I'm glad to know I'm not the only nerd obsessed with keeping copious notes in their favorite comic book series. I did the same thing with my beloved All-Star Squadron. I ended up with over 10 pages. Unfortunately, I had to downsize my lifestyle several years ago when I needed to move into a smaller place, and that was one of the unnecessities that needed to go. Oh, I'm sorry to hear that, Hal, but I'm glad I'm in good company that we both kept copious lists of JSA-related stuff. Oh, goodness. Then we heard from Rob McCarthy, author of the book The Star, The Space Princess, and Other Stories. He says, I never got to read this title, yet I saw the DC ads, but never saw the comic. Now I got to listen to the first one, as I'm a big Roy Thomas fan. Well, Rob, I hope we weren't too rough on Roy, and I hope you enjoyed the episode. Then we're from Brian Schufo, who goes, I'm really enjoying revisiting the JSA from a time when my reading took a dip. I just graduated from college and was still working part-time in a mall. I had lots of time under my hands, but very little money, but I still managed to pick up an issue or two of this series. Awesome, Brian. Well, thank you, and I'm so glad that you're enjoying the revisit. Then we heard from Gord Tolton, who does the podcast Prairie Justice, a Greg Saunders vigilante podcast. And Gord writes, I first discovered the JSA in the 1971 summer JLA-JSA team-up, that one that had the Earth 2 twins teaming up, so Superman, Flash, Green Lantern, Adam, Hawkman, and even the Robins of Two Earths meeting. Even at 8 years old, I had no problem understanding the Two Earths idea, though it would be a while before I understood that these guest stars were precursors to the original, as DC began reprinting Golden Age in various E. Nelson Bridwell edited titles, where the historian of DC explained these heroes to me in a text that I devoured. I was ready in 1972 for another summer special team up when Len Wein threw me so many curveballs with new, to me, JSAers and a few soldiers of victory, one of whom wormed into my head to create a way for Shag to be unable to say the words Prairie Justice, a Greg Saunders vigilante podcast, like a normal person. Gord, you just like making me say that, don't you? Anyway, Gord goes on to say, the JSA have always been my go-to, and even when I took my periodic hiatus from comic reading, it was always Earth 2 that drew me back. The All-Star Squadron 1981, its Paperback production, and the 1999 miniseries, and the eventual Robinson John series in 2000. And then he goes on to say, well, it's easy to cuss Mike Carlin. He wasn't wrong. While this revival did refocus many characters, such as Ted Knight and Jay and Alan, for important things to come, the truth is that the Justice Society is historic and very much a milestone of the Golden Age, and by that turn of the century, it was time for the next generations. I personally would welcome a series with a Second World War or post-war era setting, something that could tie up and let us see the Allies in the All-Star Squadron in their vital prime, as young men and women with powers and abilities that were still learning and dealing with their use and against a vital and omnipresent set of villains. That's an interesting suggestion, Gord. A few people chimed in. Richard Fields said, I agree with you that a book continuing World War II and the All-Star Squadron. Let Roy Thomas write it and Jerry Ordway could draw it. I recently discovered the All-Star Squadron run and I'm glad I did. It's awesome. If we could go back to that art and stories, I would buy in a heartbeat. Then Hal says, I would definitely love an All-Star Squadron book. The recent Alan Scott and Wesley Dodd series showed that period setting can still work. You know, Hal, I was thinking the same thing. I'm glad you said it. Hal goes on to say, I would much rather have Robinson or Wade or someone with an equal love of the legacy write it, but with a modern twist that still honors the concept. Dude, Hal, I am right there with you. Give Mark Wade a JSA book set in the 1940s. It would be astounding. Then Captain Entropy says, insightful comments, Gord. On a less mature note, I kind of want Shag to record a promo of an extreme Prairie Justice podcast episode with special guest appearances by Darkseid, but I also don't want to hear his vocal cords snap.
Well, thank you, Captain Entropy. Darkseid appreciates your loyalty.
All right. Moving on, Richard Field chimes in again and says, great show, guys. Brings back a lot of great memories. I remember going to the local comic shop back in the day. I remember picking up my Image comic pulls along with my X-Men titles, Captain America, Amazing Spider-Man, along with some Marvel UK titles. Every once in a while, the owner would add books to my weekly buys. He added Black Canary, a couple JSA books, and I loved the team. Flash was really cool, along with some of the other characters, but then my comic shop closed down, so I had to find a new place to buy my books. The new shop sometimes would get all my pulls, sometimes not. Never got me the JSA series, so I didn't get it anymore. Kind of forgot about the title, and then that shop closed down, so I stopped buying comics. Many years later, I started to get into The Invaders. Then I started to listen to some podcasts, and I was trying something different. DC Comics Who's Who, Back to the Bins, The Black Canary, and Secret Origins, All-Star Squadron podcast. Along the way, I bought the All-Star Companions because these podcasts, I started buying All-Star Squadron and I have the whole run. Now I'm buying Infinity Inc. and Young All-Stars. I even bought the rest of the JSA series you're talking about right now. I am totally engrossed in these characters. Thank you. Ah, Richard, so glad you're enjoying it and so cool that you're picking up those books now. Then we hear from one of my favorites, Gus Casals, longtime commenter over at the JLI podcast. Now he does his own Alfred Pennyworth Presents podcast and his Legion 60 Years Later podcast. He says, we are so back. File under soon-to-be-dated pop culture references. Gus continues, I love this issue so much, even though I haven't read it in 30 years. I sold my issues to a paperback fan decades ago. I had completely forgotten the cover, mistaking it for the house ad illustration, and it's so much better as an action cover, and now that I get the FF reference. Totally worth the deep dive here for the Society Pages journey. Awesome, Gus. Glad you're here. Then we heard from Little Russell Burbage from Keystone City. He has his own blog called Friends of Justice. Russell writes, a great show, guys. A little on the long side, but entertaining. Hey, Russell, that's a fair call out. Hopefully this episode is shorter. Depends on how long it's going to take me to get through this feedback. But really shooting to get the episodes down. I mean, that first one was just packed with so much extra stuff we had to cover. Anyway, Russell goes on, I have recently reread the series so I can be ready for this podcast. I have to disagree about the greatness of the cover. All right, so Gus cheered the cover. Now Russell's saying he doesn't like it. Interesting. He says, I have to disagree about the greatness of the cover. I really wish DC had used a rushing to the camera type of cover instead, which they ended up using for issue number 10. Now, Russell, I'll disagree with you there because they did use the rushing at the cover thing, rushing at you for the promotional poster that we've all been talking about. So I feel like it was out there in the zeitgeist. So the number one cover sort of echoing Fantastic Four. I don't know. I'm in that camp, but I mean, your opinion is just as valid. I'm just saying where I fall on that. Then he comes back and says, in fact, my main takeaway from this issue was that DC was totally underselling the JSA. I was disappointed that Superman showed up and that the JSA never actually fought the monster, as you pointed out. This is not what the stars of the book are supposed to do. I can imagine new fans reading the story and thinking, these guys are has-beens. I don't want to read about them. Now, I agree that there's a fine line between portraying your main characters as too old to do any good or just as elderly, but I think the writer went too over the line this time. The JSA should have saved the day and not had Superman show up and make them all look unimportant. Therefore, I much prefer the second half of the story, where Jay and Alan clearly showed that they knew what they were doing. This is what I wanted to see throughout. It's a shame the focus was not on the team for the entire issue. That being said, I agree with Shag that the moment when the JSAers are reintroduced to the loving crowd is super duper awesome. I love this so much. Russell, you make a great point about how the team didn't really impress anyone in the beginning. I personally think the writer was trying to do that intentional. I think he was trying to show in the first half why the JSA was willing to retire. And then in the back half of the same issue, so the people read the whole story, that you get to see the JSA really shine. So I think he was trying to take them on a journey through the issue, but I can totally see your points. They are from Bucky749, a.k.a. the American Samurai, who's got his own YouTube channel. Bucky says, another wonderful episode. Oh, also, by the way, last episode we talked a little bit about the Green Lantern novels. Bucky chimes in about that. He says, I heard The Sleeper Awakens mentioned. Graphic Audio did a full drama of all three books, and I've heard that they're wonderful. You might want to get the volume that focuses on Alan Scott so you can have an audio file of him saying his Green Lantern oath. You know, that's a pretty great idea, Bucky. I might have to look into that. Then we hear from Super Captain, who goes, the most recent series definitely hasn't been my favorite, but it's been good to have the JSA back in some form. The most recent resurrection of these characters did bring us the Jay Garrick, Wesley Dodds, and Alan Scott minis, and the Stargirl and the Lost Children mini, which I adore. Alan and Jay have always been my favorites. The former has been my favorite GL, and I think much of it goes back to the JSA Golden Age page, where he is identified as the big guy of the JSA. And Jay's inclusion, along with Max Mercury, Impulse, and the rest of the Flash family, was one of my favorite aspects of the Flash title in the 90s. On a personal note, thank you for giving me something fun and interesting to focus on today for a couple of hours instead of worrying about the devastation of my Western North Carolina hometown due to hurricane slash tropical storm Helene. Great job, Shaq and Michael Bailey. Looking forward to additional episodes. Super Captain, obviously all of our hearts go out to everyone that was impacted by Hurricane Helene and then Hurricane Milton. It's been a devastating and heart-wrenching few weeks for sure. Thank you for your kind words about the episode. Then we heard from Chris Franklin for the Firewater Podcast Network. He has shows such as JLU Cast, House of Frankenstein, and many more. Chris says, it occurs to me now that this comic is kind of addressing some of the same ideas that Kingdom Come will also tackle in a few years. Where does the older generation of heroes fit in? You even have a cable analog like Magog in Kingdom Come. Of course, this has more fun with it, obviously, but it's interesting to see Straczynski and Parabek were ahead of the curve. Chris, I hadn't even thought of that. That is really interesting. Then Chris goes on to say, this discussion about getting out of the way for younger readers would have made me all blustery just a few years ago. But you're right. Heck, I'm personally not the biggest fan of revealing Alan Scott as gay. I have no problem with there being gay superheroes and there being diverse representation in comics, but I don't necessarily think it fits my personal idea of the character as previously established. But I can see the potential of exploring a closeted gay hero living through the 1940s and why that appeals to a lot of readers, many younger than myself. I understand that recently Alan's miniseries was well written, and I probably will give it a shot someday. There's no doubt a lot of new Alan Scott fans who would look at the old comics I love and miss that aspect of the character they can relate to or emphasize with in some way. So yeah, growth and change is good. And I feel just by realizing that and the fact that I'm not the primary audience DC's aiming for nowadays, I've grown a little too. Then Chris goes on to say, I am all in on this 1992 JSA series. This is one of the last comic series I recall collecting on the newsstand, which is why I missed buying issue number 10. Oh no, Chris. For a while, I thought it never shipped. And DC pulled a Sonic... I thought DC pulled a Sonic Disruptors on it. Then I saw it listed somewhere, and I knew I had to track it down. I think I first noticed Mike Parabek's art on the Flash 50th Anniversary Special, where he drew the wraparound story that introduced future Flash John Fox. I was instantly taken with his deceptively clean and incredibly dynamic art. Yeah, great observation, Chris. I stole that line from you earlier in the episode, too. Really great. Great observation. There from Matthew Davis, who says, well, I'm impressed. Paul and Sean often do two-hour-long episodes of Batman Family Reunion, but they have up to five stories from 60 pages or more to cover. You only had one 22-page story. Kidding aside, it was a great episode. Thank you, Matthew. Again, hopefully this one's shorter. Then he says, Legacy has always been a staple of the JSA. Here we have it right from the start with Jesse Quick. Great observation. Absolutely true. Then we heard from Noah Tarno from the Big Quiz Thing in the I Don't Get It, the Pop Culture Get Off My Lawn cast. He says, my own JSA story. Like many, it was a JLA-JSA team-up, though in my case, it was the Banana Pants two-parter in JLA 219 and 220, where the Thunderbolt turns heel and Black Canary discovers she's her own daughter. I was crazy in love with it at the time, probably because I was 8 years old, and because Chuck Patton's art was beyond excellent, though I think even then I was a smidge creeped out by it. That led me to the All-Star Squadron, which opened the world of Earth 2 up to me, and the endless source of fascination to young superhero-obsessed Noah. I stayed on through America vs. the JSA, Crisis, the last days of the JSA, and then into the 90s with this series, which I adored every bit of. One geeky story I feel the need to share. About 15 years ago, my best friend and I were listening to the fantastic The Kinks Are the Village Green Preservation Society, which includes a great song titled Johnny Thunder. I commented to my friend that I would put that song on a JSA-themed mixtape, and he challenged me to literally do so. So I did. That exact track listing is lost to the mists of time, but I recall that in addition to the Kinks song, it included Enter Sandman by Metallica, Jumpin' Jack Flash by Rolling Stones, A Simple Twist of Fate by Bob Dylan, Rockin' Robin by Bobby Day, Starman by David Bowie, and some real reaches, including an old jazz tune called Terrific Stomp. Oh my gosh, Noah, that is fantastic. They were from Brett Young from Imaginate Design. He says, break out the prune juice and turn down the music. The Justice Society is back. A great show, Shag and Michael. I'm a big fan of the JSA from when I first discovered them as a kid in the JLA-JSA crossovers. I was always fascinated by the Earth 2 Flash and Green Lantern and how different they were than the ones I knew. This series went under my radar, but I saved it to the library on the DC Infinite app, and I'm loving it. The Mike Parabak and Mike Macklin art is incredible. It reminds me so much of Darwin Cook, and the giant creature that erupted from underground instantly reminded me of the classic Jack Kirby monster design. The whole book is beautiful just to look at. Ah, totally agree, Brett. Totally agree. Then we heard from Cymbal Pending from the Power Girl blog called Cymbal Pending. Says, I very much get the feeling that this run is something of a soft reboot, sidelining some of the previous continuity to focus on the OG team. It would explain why a certain someone who's been on the team since the 70s and saw them off to Ragnarok didn't bother to show up for their retirement show. He's, of course, referring to Power Girl, hence his Power Girl blog. Cymbal Pending continues, I give them a pass for the whole I'm too old for this, which I'm sure was good of the 90s, but from my older 21st century eyes, it feels a little hackneyed and played out. Maybe that's just a sign of how many older characters keep coming out of retirement in this day and age. You know, Cymbal Pending, you got a point. I mean, it does seem like some either former actor reclaiming a role or some character from a comic coming back. It seems like that does keep happening over and over and over. And now, it's nice thing is they're showing more respect for the older generation. But yeah, you're right. It is kind of played out. But at the same time, I'd say, you know what? This was 1992. They were ahead of the curve. Then we hear from Michael Kramer, who says, I really enjoyed this episode. I was curious as to why the Fates never showed up in the JSA during this time. I get the reasoning regarding Dr. Fate's power levels for keeping them out of being part of the team, but it would have been nice to see the Nelsons interact with their old friends. You know what, Michael? You're dead on. I can't see any reason why Kent Nelson and Inza Nelson didn't make an appearance, at the very least. That is surprising. Maybe it would have happened if they'd gone more than 10 issues. I'm not sure. Then we heard from Jose Rivera, author of Underground Adventures. Jose says, great first issue and great first episode. It was great seeing the reverence people have for the Justice Society that they pack a stadium to see their favorite heroes take the field. Even better was Clark's childlike wonder seeing the heroes together again. He may have powers far beyond those of mortal men, but in that moment he was a kid in awe. There's something so wholesome about that. And I agree that the green on Starman's cowl actually looks good. It's different, but it still reads as Starman. I also don't mind Hawkman's design. It's probably the straps are exaggerated, but it always looked to me like he was wearing a yellow tank top, and it works. Yeah, Jose, and I think they kind of addressed that in this issue where Hawkman says that no one is seeing him without a shirt on again other than Shiera, and you're right. It does look more like a tank top than the straps, and I agree. It totally works. Then we're from Mark Baker Wright from Black Rot's Toy Box and Not Your Father's Autobot podcast. Mark says, I am so grateful for DC Universe Infinite. I was only able to get a few of the 90s issues back in the day, not because I wasn't interested in following the rest, but because I was getting into college when they came out in 1992. I hadn't realized that this was Jesse Chambers' first appearance until I did a read-through of the whole series on the app in preparation for the podcast. I look forward to following along with you guys. And then Mark gives a kind of defense of Armageddon Inferno. I'll let you go out to the website and read that. It's cute. So definitely check that out. Then we heard from my buddy, JT the Exterminator. He says, I was at the incredibly impressionable age of 9 when this first issue came out, but I found it along with the other 9 issues in a 25-cent bin and had to own them, all because of Mr. Mike Parabak, who was illustrating my favorite comic book series of my childhood, The Batman Adventures. Possibly also my favorite comic book of adulthood, but we'll more on that another day. Then he says, I think the order of events for me discovering the JSA and the Golden Age DC characters started with this series due to the familiarity with the art, then grabbing some of those 100-page spectaculars from the 70s that had the Golden Age reprints in them, Wildcat and Dr. Midnight are my favorites, and then being gobsmacked by the cover of All-Star Squadron number 1 when I found it at a flea market all around the same time. So many heroes on one cover, and then that's a rabbit hole I went down and pretty much stayed down. And as a side note, yes, I was 9 or 10 years old reading comic books about senior citizens in tights and loved every issue. So either Mike Carlin is wrong, or I'm just a or I'm just a squirrely weirdo. No need to answer that. By the way, JT also pointed out to me that Back Issue Magazine number 99 has an article about Mike Parabak in it. So folks, if you dig out into your collection and grab Back Issue 99 to check out the Mike Parabak article. Then we heard from my buddy DC Dave. It says, fantastic first episode. Thanks for the fun listen. I'm doing something I never did with the JLI podcast. I'm going to read each issue along with you. Really looking forward to this as I haven't read this series since its first run. He says, my JSA origin story started with Crisis on Earth Prime. Oh, yeah, so good. So started with Crisis on Earth Prime, which led me to pick up the back issues of All-Star Comics at cons, including number 58, both immediately cemented a love for Earth 2. That's awesome, Dave. I love it. Then we're from Doug Adamson, who says, Justice Society of America was a fun book, which when we're months away from the death of Superman and extreme grim dark, DC might not have had that much faith in this book, and they possibly believe that older readers weren't interested in the same fun experiences we had with, say, the JLI era. As we were maybe expected to age out of comics, younger readers were either pointed to the remains of the Impact line or the animated Batman book, while the teenage readers were about to get all grimdark that they could handle. DC was wrong with this course, and it's clear that the fun adventure lines are the ones everyone remembers fondly, while the extreme era books are mostly forgotten, or at least tried to be forgotten. Then it goes on to say, Zero Hour is coming soonish, and I honestly think DC just didn't know what to do with the JSA at this point, and they still hadn't figured out why they were popular and how they should have properly fit into the DCU at the time. Yeah, I agree, Doug. They didn't figure out how to place the DC at this point. I think Len Strzyzewski was onto it with the legacy stuff, but I don't think DC grasped it until a little bit later. Then we'll hear from Justin Steiner from the Shoefly Pie Substack. He says, just dropping in to say that this was a great episode. Michael Bailey was a perfect guest, and your joy for these characters just radiated, and your camaraderie was very appealing. I'd forgotten that the Superman was such a prominent character in the story, but it does make sense that he would be juxtaposed with the JSA, and the fact that he was a fanboying added a nice layer to the story. Mike Parabek's art is great, of course. Very much looking forward to the next episode. Thank you, Justin. Then we'll hear from Diablo Frank from the Rolled Spine Podcasting Network. He does shows such as the Terminator Now podcast, and he's my co-host on the Blue Devil episodes of the Once Upon a Geek and more. He says, I've mentioned before, but I shall repeat, I was the kid Mike Carlin was targeting. I wanted cool, sexy people with bladed weapons. I did not want old men in pirate shirts with receding hairlines mocking the chromium age badasses that I favored. I didn't understand the modest hype around Mike Parabek at the time, but now I find his work hugely appealing, just not on Cocoon with capes. Len Strzyzewski was in his mid-30s writing this, so I'm not sure he had any real insights into aging, so this felt more like an opportunity to do Silver Age-y, mild-mannered conservative comics. These sort of corny, overly earnest Hallmark heroes really did put me off DC Comics until they started breaking and killing their icons. JSA just wasn't meeting me where I was at. Hey, Frank, different strokes for different folks, buddy. Then he talks about Paquita, who's his lady love. Paquita listened with me while I was on the road and took exception to the ceding to the next generation sentiment. Gentlemen, there is no next generation. The kids being exposed to comic book material are doing so through live action, animation, and video games. Even manga has faded internationally in recent years, almost totally absent on the subway during my trip to Japan a few years back, with the manga section shrinking in bookstores. I'm all for outreach and accessibility, but there's a solid channel for that, but monthly floppies are ours. The last of the periodical readers is Gen X, elder millennials, the odd Z stragglers, and we're it. The last comic readers are getting to the JSA age. Cater to us until we can't spare a portion of our Social Security for physical comics. Man, you know, it pains me to agree with Frank. So you know what? I'm not going to agree with Frank. I'm going to agree with his lady love, Paquita, because she is a wonderful person and makes one hell of a shepherd's pie. So I will instead agree with her. All right, then we're hearing from Tim Price from the Outcasters, Batman and the Outsiders podcast, and the Batgirl to Huntress podcast. Tim says, great first episode and one of my favorite series, period. I've reread this all-too-short JSA volume loads of times. Oddly, its being canceled may have helped me with that. Sometimes I'm in the mood for a good reread, but want something I can finish in a day or two. 10 issues is an ideal size, and it's a magical comic, so it's a double win. Parabek's art is charming, deceptively simple and cartoony, expressive, hilarious, subtle, emotional, and just great. I immediately became a fan from this series. While his style doesn't resemble Golden Age artwork, it makes me feel like a kid again, looking like modern comics targeting younger readers while having a style and storytelling that's very sophisticated and meant for all age readers. Put another way, it feels like I'm reading a Saturday morning cartoon. I get the comparisons to Bruce Timm, but I also would point out that other artists with similar approaches like Alex Toth, Ramona Fraiden, Darwin Cook, and Doc Shaner. These creators capture pure comics, and Parabek was right there in that group. Absolutely agree, Tim. Completely. And I pointed out last time, and I want to point out again, Parabek's work on this JSA series predates Batman the Animated Series. So while it may be fair to compare him to Bruce Timm, he predated Bruce Timm. This work predated Bruce Timm. And then Tim says, I also love that this first JSA series was set in the present day that's fully within the post-crisis continuity. Last days of the JSA was them still remembering Earth 2, but now we're seeing them actually integrated into the single timeline and truly being the predecessors of the JLA and being the foundation for a legacy of hero teams. So this series starts to explore what it's like for these heroes to exist in a post-crisis history and present. Tim, that is so insightful, and I love it. Thank you for sharing that. Then heard from Alan Wright, who does the Robin Hood website called boldala.com. He's also on the Straight Out of the Federation Blake 7 podcast. He says, great show, Shag and Michael. Really looking forward to exploring this much overlooked era of the JSA. On a subject of preferring the modern All-Star Squadron takes over the Golden Age takes. So what he's referring to is that was last time. Me and Mike had both kind of said we prefer reading the characters in, say, All-Star Squadron versus actually reading the Golden Age comics themselves. We just kind of prefer the 1980s version of that. So he says, whatever you do, do not calculate how many years from All-Star Comics number 3 to All-Star Comics number 1 and then All-Star Comics number 1 to now. So, of course, with Alan saying that, of course I did it. So here we go, folks. From All-Star Comics number 3, which is the first appearance of the JSA in the Golden Age in 1940, up to All-Star Squadron number 1 in 1981, it was a 40 years. So that when they did All-Star Squadron number 1, they were retelling how the world looked 40 years before that. Now, from All-Star Squadron number 1 in 1981 to today, it's been 43 years. Holy moly. So the All-Star Squadron interpretation of the Golden Age has now been, I guess, around longer, if you will, than the original Golden Age itself when All-Star Squadron premiered. Oh, that makes my head hurt. Okay. Thanks, Alan, for making me feel ancient. Then we heard from J. David Weider from the Bat Pod, and formerly of Dave's Daredevil podcast. Dave says, I remember getting convinced to buy the first issue of the series when my local comic shop guy said that it would be a fun series. Not a funny series, but a fun series. That sold me on the spot. Dave, that's a great description. I love it. Then we're from Ben Sherman, who says, that was a lot of fun, and I learned some things as usual. I'm just getting into the now-ending JSA series, so I'll let you know soon whether I concur with your feelings about it. I'm very much enjoying the ride and looking forward to the next episode. Well, thank you, Ben. Then we heard from Chuck Kriga Loridens, who says, I bought the whole run on eBay after listening to your podcast. All right, folks, there it is. We're helping the economy right then and there. Chuck, I am honored that you went out and bought the comic after listening, so I hope you enjoy it. All right, folks, now we did receive a lot of kind words from a lot of people about the first episode. I just want to name check some folks who sent me messages personally or just left very, very brief comments. So thank you to Jim Beard, Peter Watson, David Steele, John Stribe, Trey Lawson, Joe Crow, and David T.L. Thank you, guys. I really appreciate it. Now, this is the part of the show where I thank everyone who shared JSA Presents or JSA in the 90s on their social media timeline. That means Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, Threads, and Blue Sky. This is a long list of names. I am aware. Don't worry. However, these folks showed their support and promoted the show. So it's very important to me that we recognize these individuals. For example, this is the only time in the episode I'm going to mention Craig McDonald. But you know what? He helped promote the show and he deserves to be shouted out as well. This time out, we've got over 70 names of people who helped promote the show recently. So here's everyone who helped promote the show by sharing or retweeting or whatever the heck it's called on the other platforms. Again, Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, Blue Sky, and Threads. You could be on this list next month. All you got to do is share. So our thanks go to A World on Fire, an All-Star Squadron podcast, Al Girding, Alan Boyce, Andre Lashley, Andrew R., Dr. Ange, Between the Pages blog, Bill Beer, Billy Delicious, Brian Schufo, Chris Franklin, Chris Lewis, Christopher Luke, Comic Foil, Craig McDonald, Dan Doherty, Dave's Comic Heroes blog, David Ace Gutierrez, David Steele, DC Dave, Derek Crabb, Dr. Pop Culture, Ed Moore, Giancarlo, Gus Casals, J. David Weider, Jake Muir, John Stibe, J.P. Rocha, Justin Steiner, Keechee Baker, Con L, M.A. Salko, Mark Baker Wright, Martin Gray, Martin Kogan, Max Romero, Michael Bailey, Michael Kramer, Mo Walker, Nuno Duarte, Outcasters, Batman and the Outsiders podcast, Paul Kean, Paul Wildenberger, Peace Bound and Down, a Wonder Woman podcast, Pedro Angosto, Pete Flower, Prairie Justice, the Greg Saunders Vigilante podcast, Pulp Fiction Comics Culver City, Relatively Geeky Podcast Network, Richard Field, Rob Kelly, Robert Junker, Roger Preeb, S. Matthew Stolte, Scott X, Sean Ross, Silverman on Security, Siskoid, Sports and Comics, Stop, Let's Team Up, a comic podcast, Symbol Pending, The Bat Pod, The DC Sendence, The Earth 2 Podcast, The Only American Captain Britain Fan, Tim Price, Venkman, Warlock Thanos Podcast, Willie Arbro, Right On Network, and Zek Cap Boots. Whew. My thanks to all of you. You guys are amazing. Thank you so much for supporting the JSA in the 90s podcast. Your feedback is so critical to this show. I feel like the community of JSA fans we're building together is so fantastic. Please, please keep your cards and letters coming. And if I've forgotten or missed anyone, I am terribly sorry. It is probably the fault of Michael Bailey. I will do my best to find all the social media comments, but sometimes they do slip through my internet finger. So again, if I missed you, just let me know. So again, contribute to the conversation. The best place is go out to our website, which is firewaterpodcast.com/JSA. Leave your comments on the show post there, and fellow JSA fans can share their thoughts and you guys can communicate together. But also find us on social media platforms as JSA Presents, including Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, Blue Sky, and Threads, or you can email us at justicesocietypresents@gmail.com. Again, thank you so much to all of you for such a great collection of feedback. Now, we're going to take a quick podcast promo break, and when we come back, we'll see if this episode's guest, Sean Ross, has successfully kept out any unwanted business entrepreneurs.
You're listening to Prairie Justice, a Greg Sanders Vigilante podcast.
You heard right, partners. The Vigilante rides again.
From across the western plains and into the streamlined east flashes a mystery rider symbolic of the spirit of frontier America, the Vigilante, heroic champion of law and order, who battles 20th century criminals with weapons of the range in a ceaseless one-man stampede against all lawlessness. Follow the victory trail of the prairie troubadour, Greg Saunders, and his alter ego, the Vigilante, as he rounds up public enemy number one with smoking six guns and twirling lariat. Meanwhile, back at the ranch, Prairie Justice, the Greg Saunders Vigilante podcast, climbs into the saddle on Podbean and Apple Podcasts.
Grab your bat microphone. It's time to start the show.
Welcome to the Bat Pod, a Batman comic book discussion podcast.
What are you doing? That's my line.
I'm starting the show. I was waiting on you. We're starting the show.
I'm the one that says that. You're my new co-host, where we talk about back issues of Batman. Could be in Detective Comics, World Finest.
Could we do some Shadow of the Bat and maybe some Nightwing, maybe some Batgirl?
Absolutely.
Can we also define where my co-hosting parameters start and end? I can't start the show, but I can definitely co-host it.
Well, maybe we'll let you start the show.
Okay, at least I get to pick one of the books we're covering on each episode, and you could pick the other?
Absolutely.
Can I close out the show? Can I bring friends? Will there be snacks?
What is your favorite bat snack?
Cucumber sandwiches.
Join Bill Beer and J. David Weider every 2 weeks on the Bat Pod. You can find us on your favorite podcast app.
Grab your headphones, listen up. You know you love it. Drop the facade. Like the Dark Knight Detective, they've got some perspective. They're a pure crime-fighting collective. It's the Bat Pod.
Okay, folks, we're back from break. And yeah, I did tell you it's going to be a shorter episode. Oh, thank goodness. And we do have Sean back with us. So first, Sean, my thanks to you for appearing on this episode of the show. Why don't you tell the listeners where they can find you on the internets?
Yeah, thank you so much for having me. I love this series. I'm so excited that you're doing this show. I hope this show runs for 20 years and you cover every single thing that involves the JSA. And you know, I'm super excited because you're hitting, you know, a book I love and a team I love. So very excited to be on this episode. So folks can find me online. I'm at Sean42AZ on X. I'm Sean FWP on Facebook. And you can find me at the Fire and Water Podcast Network. I have a show called Peace Bound and Down, a Wonder Woman podcast. First episode with Dr. Anna Papard is out. It answers the question, who is Wonder Woman? The next episode will be coming soon with Dr. Ange, where we're going to cover the end of Wonder Woman Volume 1, her quote-unquote death in Crisis, and then her quote-unquote rebirth in Legends. It's a super fun comic. It's filled with comic booky goodness, and only from the Fire and Water Podcast Network.
Well, at the time of this recording, I've only heard episode one, and holy moly, folks, what an episode. It makes everything else on the network pale in comparison. It is an incredible, I mean, it's not Sean, he's an idiot. His guest was amazing, yeah. So I cannot recommend that first episode enough. It is so stinking good, so I'm so glad you doing that show, Sean, and I cannot wait to listen to it every month. Looking forward to it, buddy.
Thank you.
All right, folks. Well, that's going to do it. Now, come back next episode when we cover Justice Society of America number 3, and we'll find out who the mystery stranger in the JSA headquarters was. And I'll be joined by another fantastic guest to help me cover the issue. Who will it be? Come on, people. I think you know how this works. You're just going to have to wait and find out next episode. Thanks for listening, folks. Until next time, I'm Shag.
And I'm Sean.
And we're asking you to join the fight
for justice.